And now on Radio National Summer, we're replaying the highlights of this year's Street Stories, including a number of programs that won awards. Today, the winner of this year's Human Rights Award, which was produced and presented by Kath Dwyer.
I sometimes imagine what it's like, and if you close your eyes and you can't talk, and you're in a chair or you're lying on a bed, people come and talk to you and he knows what's going on, he understands everything, but he's trapped.
Eight years ago, Chris Nolan went to bed one night and woke up 6 months later, unable to move, see or speak. He'd suffered a massive brain injury and he's now what's known as locked in, unable to use his muscles to form words or write or signal how he feels, but still conscious and able to hear and understand everything that's going on around him. Now at the age of 36, he lives in an aged care nursing home. In his single room in inner city Melbourne, Chris is an unlikely candidate for an old people's home. By all accounts, he's a full-on guy with a passion for life, people and music. And despite his limited ability to communicate, he's managed to keep up a wide circle of friends and even make new ones. It's unusual. Most people with such severe injuries find their friends stop coming pretty quickly, so that by the end of the first year, it's common for only family and paid professionals to visit. But despite the difficulties, Chris and his friends have learned how to have a conversation where only one person talks.
I don't know, you just go and talk to him like you would one of your friends, and if you like talking, then it's easy.
And do you like talking?
Yeah, I like talking, it's great fun.
Nolan, how are you going, mate? How are you?
You know that he's never going to dob on you, or he's never going to, the secret's never going to get out, so you can quite happily tell him things that are personal. Easily, and I'm sure that he's delighted to have the information.
That's right. Ozzy, we brought some CDs. Small Goods, they're pretty good. Melbourne band.
We're in Chris's room. My name's Matt, and Chris is sitting next to us. You might be able to hear him grinding his teeth. The room is an average-sized bedroom, with all the trappings of a 50s nursing home, bad mushroom-coloured curtains, some rank lime paint, lots of pictures of Chris's activities and previous pursuits and current pursuits on the wall, a lot of medical kind of equipment, and a rolling hospital bed that he sleeps in. Now, my brother met someone the other day that takes people in wheelchairs snow skiing. Imagine how shit-house you'd be at that. I mean, you would have been rank. Oh, you might have skied.
I certainly don't come to the nursing home anywhere near as often as I should. It's always great when I do. We, sit down and usually he's pretty attentive, and it's absolutely great to sit down and talk like we've always talked.
Was it hard for you to work out how to have a conversation with Chris after his injury when it was clear that he couldn't talk back to you?
Yeah, for sure. For a long time, that was really, really hard, because at first you feel like you can make a few jokes, and then once you've got no jokes, then there's just silence, and that's really, really... That was very confronting at first. I had no idea how to, how to converse or how to communicate. And then he's grinding his teeth terribly here. He's desperate to talk. I can tell something there has triggered something. Looks like he actually wants to punch me right now. He's grizzling. Well, I've said the wrong thing. Come on, Nolsey, I'm doing my best here, Tiger. But then it became apparent that you could just sit here and, talk about music or talk about shit or just not talk at all. And that was completely fine. Very confronting at first, though, when you're not getting input or stimulation back in a verbal sense. It's, you've got no skills to work out how to do it at first.
And so how did you work it out? Is it just practice?
Oh, I think his mum had to tell me, cut a long story short, that it's okay to just sit there if there's nothing much going on. And then, yeah, constancy and practice, and you finally work out how you can form some common ground conversationally.
Some of these you're going to hate. I actually got Arches of Love. You know that song, Stuck a Needle in My Backbone.
I'm Jeremy Smith, and these are my children, Linus and Lulu. I still have these sort of awkward silences with Chris. There's a lot of silence. Sometimes it's awkward, sometimes it's not, but that's sort of the nature of male relationships, I think. It's like, you know, sitting there with your dad or something. I think every bloke knows what that's like, and so I'm not convinced that it's... Sometimes I'm not convinced it's that unusual. Yeah, I met him in 1990 at Monash. I remember I met him in a toot, actually, where I had a particularly vacant moment, and I was asked a question, and this bloke next to me just very discreetly with his pencil pointed to the right case, and I mentioned that case, and that was consequentially the answer to the question. And I thought that was pretty good, so that was an indication of the sort of bloke Chris is.
Chris Nolan back then, well, he was a wild boy. He was one of those guys that his eyes sort of, you know, like, he had shiny eyes. He was lit up, you know.
We always used to call him the mayor, because whatever it was that he was involved in, he would run it, basically. And he would be the key social cog in whatever kind of, you know, little group he was in.
He was the captain of his cricket team, captain of his school. He was great at sport, great at school. He was a really, you know, great socialiser. Always a lot of people around him. Always some music going on, either live music or loud music, one or the other. Both, usually, loud and live.
By all accounts, Chris was an energetic, charismatic guy. Always up for a beer, a night out, or an argument, especially about music. His passion for loud, heavy music was well known and led him and a couple of mates to set up the Meredith Music Festival on Chris's parents' property in rural Victoria. Chris was always a hard one to pin down, and by 1996 he'd left Australia to work as a lawyer in Vietnam. And then one night he went out, went home to bed and never woke up. He'd suffered an hypoxic brain injury, a lack of oxygen to the brain. Doctors still don't know why it happened, but what was clear from the outset was that Chris was never going to walk, see or talk again. Workmate Chris McLeod.
Yeah, it was all a bit confusing. I remember someone just said, oh, Nolsey's crook, and they've flown him to Singapore, and it was pretty hard to believe. And then there was days I remember where, you know, everyone was concerned about, you know, whether he was going to pull through.
The news travelled like wildfire, and it was mind-blowing, because especially when I went to see Chris in St V's very early on when he arrived back in Melbourne, and that was just like, you know, gowning up and going in and seeing somebody with all these tubes, and it just looked quite bizarre to see such a... Like a powerful man now lying, you know, skin and bones in a bed in a very helpless looking situation.
Sort of knew that he'd had a brain injury, but we didn't know, you know, you didn't know what does that mean? Is he gonna just lie there? Is he gonna, you know, start talking again, or, you know, is he gonna have a bit of trouble walking around, or, you know, what's the problem? And really it was only, you know, many months later that we sort of understood what actually was going on and what his, I guess, life and would be like in the future.
The other thing I suppose was there too for me is like, there was a bit of horror there. I was like, oh, whoa, this is like horrible. You know, like it wasn't something I enjoyed experiencing. It wasn't like, you know, let's go and see Chris. Isn't it going to be great? It was always like, oh God, you know, inflicting this on myself again. I didn't enjoy the experience of going to visit him at all.
8 years after his injury, Chris lives in an aged care nursing home in inner-city Melbourne. His room is covered with photos of him partying with family and friends and posters of his favourite bands. But walk down the corridor and you're in a different world.
There you go, Grandma.
People live here because they're at the end of their lives, but Chris is here because funding battles between state and federal government departments mean there's nowhere else for people like him to go. Like several hundred other young people around the country, he faces the rest of his life in an aged care nursing home.
It seems to attack all your senses, really. It smells different, it sounds different. You're hearing noises and people in various stages of dementia. And you have to walk past that to get to Chris's room. And Chris has got his own room. And in there, there's the music and there's posters up on the wall. And it's more what you'd hope. But getting there is a bit of a battle some stage. And there's still friends of ours, that male friends, that haven't visited Chris.
The staff are always really fantastic and friendly, but the environment, you know, it's a place where people are at the final stages of their life before they die. And that's really, really not great for someone who's in their 30s to be in. And it's unpleasant, and it's unpleasant to see our friend in it.
Josh has been looking forward to coming to see you today, going to Chris's house. And Josh, have you given Chris 3 kisses? I don't think you've given him 3 kisses. Are you ready? Give him 3 kisses. Oh, come on. Look, he's smiling already. Chris is smiling already. Well, we'll do that when you leave. We'll do that when you leave.
He used to share a room with some old guys, and they'd keep rotating through because they'd keep dying on him. And Chris, you know, he's not going anywhere. He's a long-term resident, which is unusual, and he'd get close to these guys, you know, he'd know them, or they'd talk to him and they'd talk to each other, and the visitors would come in and he'd get all upset when he's, you know, I guess they were his mates in his room, and they'd die, you know, quite often.
It wasn't a conscious decision not to go anymore. It was just, I just kept putting it off and it went away, exactly. Like, the longer it went, the longer it was going to be, you know, so it was like, oh yeah, it's been a year now, so, you know, like, you know, another year on top of that and another year on, so it was... Yeah, it was like it had gone into the past. It had drifted into an experience of the past, and somehow, you know, Chris had gone from my life.
So, Chris, I'm just going to read a little bit of Tim Winton's Land's Edge to you, because you always enjoy that, and so do I. A still summer night, a world away, in a house that smells of cactus and dust and musty kapok. I am 6 years old and almost asleep in the hollow of the clapped-out mattress. Outside in the Tuesday dark, a high tide cracks against the bar at the river mouth. My skin is pleasantly tight with sunburn and smelling of vinegar. A stubbed toe throbs under the lightness of the sheet. The fridge kicks in and whirs across the sleeping sounds of my mother, my father, my sister and brother. Wonderful. Just takes you out of this room. All right, Chris, we'll just head out for a walk. My name's Eileen, and I first met Chris when he came to live at the nursing home in Fitzroy, and I was a nurse there. Then it was a relationship, it was just a nurse-patient relationship, but throughout that time, yes, I think we just sort of became friends.
Okay, Chris, I don't know what the weather's doing at the moment. It's still mild.
It's been a bit muggy today. Having a friendship with someone who doesn't speak, I think it makes you have to be so much more honest than even you might be otherwise, in the sense of you have to call it as it is, because Christopher cannot ask you a question to clarify. So you've got to be as honest as you can be. Chris also responds with absolute honesty. Chris can't pretend.
You know, if I walk in and say g'day and Chris smiles and, you know, that's great. That's how I'd love it to be every day. But some days I might come and visit and Chris is not smiling. You know, he just might be doing it hard. But he can't pretend, you know, he's not going to put on a smile because he can't. He can't contrive it. The responses that you get from Chris are usually elicited by the emotion he feels. That's when you'll get the greatest response. So if Chris finds something amusing, he can't stop his laughter.
You're smiling now, aren't you? Hey? You were shitty before. Something was wrong, wasn't it? I don't know what it was. Something I said there made you want to punch me. I can't wait till you get out of this and you can tell me exactly what was going on. First thing will probably be shut up, Rexy. With your Yeah, that's it, eh? Shut the hell up, Rexy, with your nonsense. The minute you can talk back, I'm going to get the biggest verbal barrage of all time, I reckon. You're going to hold... What you're going to do is you're going to tape me to a chair, tape my mouth shut and just talk absolute rubbish to me for 5 or 6 years. And go, there, Rexy. And I tell you what else, your music taste is terrible. That's exactly what you're going to do. Got a big grin on his face.
At the start, when, you know, he'd be conscious, people were saying, oh, look, I think that he may be understanding. I was a bit of a sceptic and I thought, oh, no, he's buggered. There's no one there, you know. And even in the early days when, maybe even when he went to the nursing home and Mary said, I think he understands, he knows what's going on, I was still a bit sceptical, but... You know, and then over time it just became obvious that he knew, you know, 100% what was going on, and it was, in some ways it was a bit scary that I'd sort of written him off and he was definitely still there.
In some ways that would have sat easier with me if there wasn't an awareness there. There's nothing you have to deal with. But the underlying thing there really was that I was terrified. It's a horrible thing to say about my own self, but I was just terrified of being with a disabled person.
Christopher, I'm just going to give you something to eat. Sorry, you haven't had much attention today, have you? I'm giving Christopher something through his pet tube, which goes directly into his tummy, because it takes a long time for him to actually eat. So that's one of the things to... It gives him real pleasure, as different tastes and foods, and it's got to be pureed, but hopefully he'll get to a bit more than that. Oh, well, I'm Mary Nolan, Chris's mother, Mims.
Well, I'm Jack, or John, Christopher's dad. I do feel at times he gets very depressed, and I couldn't see how it could be any different because... not to be able to communicate and, you know, listen to some of the conversations at times and not be able to reply to it must be very difficult. And I often think of it myself, you know, how would you feel? I don't think I could cope. He's definitely a fighter.
Stubborn, I reckon.
Stubborn.
Stubborn as a mule.
In the early days, you knew that Chris knew what was going on, but it was very difficult to convince other people of that. How did Chris's friends help in that process of getting the wider world to see that Chris was still Chris?
The way they related with him, I mean, Chris was in coma for the first 6 months and he woke up laughing at a joke. And his friends know his sense of humour, so they'd come in and tell him a story or they'd relate with him just normally and tell him some bullshit sort of stuff. And he'd laugh. So people looking on saw that and thought, my God, something's happening here.
So who else is coming in boring the shit out of you today, Nilesy? Someone else? Who's on the hit parade? It's a bit like a chat show, isn't it? Maybe you could have your own tonight show where you just fucking sit there. That'd be great. I'll be right into it. You can see 1,000 different subtleties in his face. Sheer anger, frustration, grinding of the teeth, you know, twitching of the head. You can see him physically struggling to try and say something or to, he's just agitated right through to complete and utter joy and laughter. He's also got a long blink that he's developed with the people that look after him, and that means yes. If you ask him a question and wait for a long blink, which can take several seconds, that means yes. He and I have never really used that. We probably underutilise it a bit because, you know, probably because I talk too much and don't stop and ask him questions. But, I mean, we know each other and we can communicate without talking so much.
I believe that he can feel the emotion in the room. So if you're laughing and up, then he can feel that energy quite well. If you're grumpy or whatever, then he knows that you're grumpy pretty quickly.
So will you still go and see him when you are grumpy or down, or will you save it up for when you're feeling good?
I tend to have a regular sort of time where I go and see Chris. So you tend to go anyway, just because it's habitual, I suppose. So there'd be times when you don't really feel like doing it and you're doing it anyway. Everyone does that with lots of different things. In that case, you know, you might not stay as long or you might not have such a good time while you're there. But generally you can swing it around. I mean, if you're going there to see a friend, then no matter what mood you're in, generally you can get something out of it.
How did you reconnect with Chris after nearly 8 years since his injury?
There's a book that came out, The Inability Possibility, which Mary was behind, and it was being launched, and Mary wanted someone to play some songs. And see, I'd always written songs and played songs with, you know, at when we'd lived together. Rexy said to Mary, "Oh, why don't you get Doss to play some songs?" And I found myself at the nursing home in Chris's room by myself. It was just the two of us, you know, because it'd almost been like we'd been having a conversation around Chris, and I'd never really had the one-on-one, just the two of us in the same room. And I just started having a conversation with him and talking to him, and I mentioned something about some friends of ours who always crack us up. And Chris started laughing, like really started laughing. But, and he totally followed the thread of the conversation and was chipping in with appropriate responses. And I just thought this was amazing. And it was at that time that I really felt the connection. It was just that, like, coming together of beings. You know, it's like it doesn't need words or anything else. But it was that special moment you have when you feel that there's love. I suppose that's the word for it. I'm a bloke, I don't say that sort of, you know, yeah, love.
I'm that one. That's all right. Well, we've got a lot of stuff, and I've still got a lot of work on the document.
It's a Sunday afternoon in the Nolan City home. It's close to the nursing home, but about 2 hours' drive from the real family home at the farm at Meredith, where Chris's father Jack lives full-time. His mother Mary spends most of her time in Melbourne, and most Sundays brings Chris back to the house for a break from the nursing home. More recently, some of his friends have been getting together here to work out how they can help Chris in the future. A critical issue is where he's going to live, because his current nursing home in the inner city is due to close sometime soon, and the place he's been offered is at least an hour's drive away in one of the outer suburbs of Melbourne.
What do you guys want to happen for Chris?
Well, I don't think we know 100%. Yeah, that's one of the key issues we're trying to determine, I suppose. I don't necessarily know exactly what we want to the nth degree. However, we know what we don't want. So it's much more of a negative than a positive at this stage. We know what the negative is that we don't want, i.e. moving out to an outer eastern suburb of Melbourne, a long way away from the inner city where his friends are, you know, those sorts of issues, and it's a large place, and it's an old people's nursing home. It's not for a young person, which is the whole crux of the thing we're driving at, of course.
There's a whole lot of different things thrown into the mix, like having Chris in places where you can be sure that he's going to keep meeting people and drawing people into his life. That's not really easy to do, for instance, if he's out at Eltham, because he can get out and about no worries, except it's nowhere near any of the places that interest him and are going to stimulate him, and it's also nowhere near his friends. So Chris needs to be able to keep expanding his world as well, not just us expanding our world.
Isolation for Christopher would be hell, and isolation is endemic for people like him. Non-speaking people are generally regarded as not there. So they're non-people in a sense. They can't speak for themselves, they have no voice, so they're easily forgotten. I mean, if I were trapped in a body and communication system that wouldn't work for me, you know, I'd want people to be able to recognise the way I am communicating, or at least to try, and also to try to interpret it. And you can't do that on your own. You need a group, you know, if there's a decision to be made, I'll get a couple of friends to come in and see what Christopher, what response they're getting, so that, you know, we can fine-tune and be more accurate and true to him.
We're not getting younger. That's their biggest worry. early days, you know, people were saying, oh, you know, they're lucky if they survive 5 years or whatever it may be. Well, it certainly looks like if he'll outlive us, and it's what will happen to him then. And that's why this group that's been formed is there to try and get something set up for the future.
How important has it been for you to have those friends of Chris's around?
It sort of brings Christopher's life alive, having those people. You know, a lot of people say, how do you cope? Well, you cope by having such great friends around you. They haven't walked away, so you certainly can't.
I still get something good out of the friendship. You don't have to talk to enjoy being in someone else's company. Any friendship grows and waxes and wanes depending on circumstances. And I would probably see him more now than I did immediately before he fell over. So I'd like to think that the friendship that we've got now is maybe stronger than it was just before he got into strife.
I'm not sure that the relationship has changed that much. It's changed in the physical sense of where you meet and how you meet and the circumstances in which you meet and your capacity to communicate. But I don't know, he's just a sort of a friend going through a rough trot, I suppose, an extended rough trot.
Over 6,000 people aged under 65 live in aged care nursing homes around the country. About 250 of them are aged under 40, many the victims of brain injury who've lost the ability to speak on their own behalf. Many thanks today to Chris Nolan, his parents Mary and Jack, and all his friends. Music in today's program was by Dirty Three, a firm favourite at the Meredith Music Festival and in Chris's nursing home room. Thanks also to Vicky Kerrigan, and for technical production, Judy Rapley. I'm Kath Dwyer.
What do you think? Was it all right? Do you put your stamp of approval? And I'm surprised you didn't fall asleep. I'll take that as a good gauge that it wasn't too dull. Eh? But then you'd probably say, Eileen, you were talking about me. Eh? It's never dull.
Since this program first went to air, Chris's nursing home has closed, and he was found interim care in another aged care facility. While the Victorian government has made a commitment to find an appropriate home for him and others like him, it's still a few years away. Next week on Street Stories, one of the runners-up in this year's Human Rights Awards, about the stolen generation returning home to live. I hope you can join us then.